and I raise heritage corn varieties, beans, squash, potatoes, Jerusalem artichokes, tobacco, and then all kind of things like I like eggplant too. My point would be is that a lot of those seeds are, they're smart. Like that corn that that girl is holding, that is a Mandan variety. I grew it on my field. I grew it because it's a drought-resistant variety. And I grew that in the year that they had a drought, that same year that I got arrested in a war that depends. It was 2021. I grew this corn. Montano varieties did not hold, but my varieties did. My corn held because heritage varieties are smart. They have a brain, and they're intelligent. They aren't created by Monsanto. And so in the times of climate change, what we need to grow is the heritage varieties, because they're the varieties that can adapt, and they're the ones that are smart, and they're the ones that didn't need petroleum and don't need it now. So remember that as spring comes, and I know that Eugene is full of such cool plants. This is what I do. I grow hemp. We bought out these guys called RDO Offit, single large potato farmers, really evil potato farmers as it is, and they contaminate this land, and hemp is really an amazing crop. I grow textile hemp. My main work is in fiber hemp varieties. And so I've been growing varieties, and you know, we grew varieties from China, from France, from Spain, from the Czech Republic, from Romania. And then I really like to grow the feral varieties. So that's what I've been working on with the University of Minnesota, because it turns out that that ditchweed, that's what we're talking about. They try to eradicate hemp, and so it's been illegal for like 80 years, right? But some of it is hanging on. And like all kind of cool places, a lot of them around some of our native reservations where the wild things are. And there you find these feral varieties of hemp. And I figure anything that grew illegally for 80 years is very tough. You following me on this? This is what you want, right? And so I'm working with the University of Minnesota because my stepfather worked at the Oregon State University at the Agricultural Extension. And so I was raised around guys who did plant varieties. And so what I'm interested in is building a gene, building the seed stock for the new green revolution. And that's the hemp revolution. That's the hemp revolution. But you got to have the seeds for the revolution. And you can't just have a few marijuana seeds. That's not going to do you. You need hundreds of thousands of pounds of seeds. So think of it this way, about 4 acres of hemp will get you a house. Do you guys hear that? And you could grow it and put your house up in the same year, and you can sequester more carbon with that than any other field crop, and you can have a house that is carbon negative, and you can do it in a year, and you can actually save a forest. Y'all follow me on this one? So that's what we're after. And so I'm organizing this cooperative, you know, and Oregon is like way too uptight about this because everybody got into marijuana. And what you guys need to do is you need to get into hemp. That's what you need to do, because that's going to save your forests. That's going to save your forests, and that's going to bioremediate what is going on out there. And you're going to be able to make paper, and you're going to be able to make houses, and you're going to be able to make houses that don't burn. That's why you want to grow hemp. So 2 years ago, 2023, Patagonia did a bag with us. That's my hemp from my field. And that hemp went to, isn't that cool? That's very cool, isn't it? Okay, so that hemp went to, just to tell you my story, that hemp went from my reservation to North Carolina to get decorticated. Then it went to Virginia to get degummed. Then it went to Mexico to get spun. Then it went to Washington State to get woven. And then it went to California to get cut and sewn so that we could bring you a bag that looks like this. That's awesome, huh? Now, the only problem is that that's what happens when you deconstruct a textile industry, right? And we used to make all that stuff here. And that's what we need to do again, right? That's what how you do it. And so that is my next bit of work. It's going to take me a few years here. But there's a lot of us working on it. And this is my next round of hemp. This is my hemp that went to, our hemp that went to and got spun at Battenkill Fibers, Battencourt Fibers. And then this is a couple of my sons and a hempcrete house at Lower Sioux with a solar thermal panel on it that my guys put in. And that, I think, is the house of the future. And that's to say solar thermal reduces your heating bill by about 30%. Solar takes heat and light, turns it into energy, and then maybe you turn it back into energy or light. But solar thermal just gets hot and goes directly into the house. When it gets around 90 degrees, a fan goes on, thermostat kicks off, fan goes on, puts warm air in the house. So what you want to do is figure out how to consume less, right? And that's what we all got to do. We all got to figure out how to live a little lighter on Mother Earth. And y'all know that because you're here in Eugene, which is where cool people ride bikes. But my point would be, this is the housing of the future. That's my point. This is my house edition, with one of my girlfriends in it. And that is hemp panels that were put together in Bismarck. Hempcrete panels, 6 foot wide, hauled out there on a semi, the walls put up in 4 hours. That's the housing for the future, especially for a lot of tribal communities that need thousands of homes and have no trees. So I'm working on the Northern Plains organizing. Do you like my campaign title, Let My People Grow? It's very biblical and all. Anyway, this is what we're working on because hemp is still like dastardly, dangerous crop, which is ridiculous. If you really wanted to smoke my field, you're a complete idiot. So what is the lesson in this, you know? I'm just saying I come from a community that nobody would bet on. Is that fair? You know, everybody would say, no, wipe those Indians off. I ain't going to amount to much. And then, you know, one day you look out there and you say, well, I guess no one's going to fix that one for us, huh? And so then we just go and start fixing it ourselves. I guess that's part of what I'm saying. You know, this is what it is to have agency. This is what it is to take your power. This is what it is to, you know, to jimis awabandameng, make that beautiful future, make that dream and make that beautiful future that you believe. And so we do that together. And we do that in community. We do that in our gardens. We do that in our housing. We do that as we teach our children. I mean, in the show of Washington, take your power back. Because it is ours. It is not theirs. It is our power. And, you know, as we move ahead in our work, you know, I came here to speak about the rights of nature. And what I want to say is that, you know, we declared the rights of wild rice in our territory in northern Minnesota. The rights of the river were recognized in Aotearoa, the Klamath River. The rights of mountains have been recognized. And in Ecuador, they enshrine the rights of nature in the Ecuadorian constitutional law. And a few years ago, corporations tried to get into some of that territory. The Ecuadorian Supreme Court, I think in 2022, ruled that the rights of nature superseded the rights of corporations. And, you know, that is really kind of, that's post-colonial law, isn't it? And that's kind of where we need to be going. You know, because what those old people always told us is that the Creator's law is the highest law. Higher than the laws made by nations, states, or municipalities, and one would do well to live in accordance with the Creator's law. And in our jurisprudence systems and in our covenant, reaffirmation of our covenant, the rights of nature is how we reaffirm that in law. As I close out this wonderful time I have with you and we open for some questions or we have some discussion, and I give you my love for being here today. It is so heartwarming to see all of you. Then just remember, you know, that it is spring that is coming. You know, this is a Zapatista saying or a Mexican saying. They tried to bury us. They didn't know we were seeds. And so that is really us. Be the seeds. Be the seeds. Be the seeds of whether it is the seeds of the food or the seeds of the ideas, the seeds of the heart, you know, be those seeds and distribute and germinate them widely. Because spring is coming, and we will need to be those people who share our seeds. Because that is how change is made. And that is how summer comes and food comes to our tables and dreams come to our hearts. So Miigwech, thank you for your time, and I really appreciate y'all. Miigwech.
So we are very grateful that you're here, Winona. So we have some questions we quickly made for you. The first one being, you've been really deeply involved in resisting pipelines and extractive industries. How do you stay resilient in the face of corporate and governmental pushback?
Well, I come from tough people. All of our ancestors had to make struggles. Some of us shoulder different things. We all carry different things. So just, you know, I don't want to say chin up, buttercup. Sometimes I say that, though. I'm just like, come on, let's go, girls. And then you reaffirm things with life. You know, you fight the bad guys, but then go do your ceremony, go do your dance. You know, bring your joy to things, you know, because they're all ugly. You know, their behavior is ugly. They didn't even have good music. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember that in the pipeline battle, we would show up and we'd be like all dressed fabulously, right? And they'd be like in their like khakis, all uptight, jerk stuff, you know? I was like, they don't got no dance moves, they got nothing. So just remember, we got that, you know? So keep it and do it, you know?
As Indigenous students, you know, we're trying to balance the two worlds of academia and holding on to our cultural traditions. And what is some advice you have for Indigenous students trying to balance both of these worlds?
So my special trick is that I wrote most of my papers at Harvard on struggles. That was my special trick. I decided, like, if you got a Harvard education, first of all, someone is paying for that. So you better make sure that you get what you want out of it. And so it's really important that you're accountable for the gift that you have. And so I wrote a lot of stuff like that. And then, I'm not very competitive, it turns out. I just like, I hope the creator thinks I did a good job. You know, so that's it. You know, just do your best. And then see, you know, like in this balance, and you could find it, you know, and then cut yourself a little slack. You got this chance at this college or this university, and you know, you guys get to learn, you get classes I never would have had when I was like back in the day. I want to go to school here. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like they got cool classes, so just go take some cool ass class about something you never knew nothing about. Just because that's cool, that's great too, you know?
What gives you hope for the future of Indigenous-led movements for environmental justice? How can Indigenous youth be more involved?
Did you see those pictures of my grandchildren? There you go. That's what you do. You bring them. You take them. I mean, they was camping at Standing Rock. Like, we all lived in different times. You know, I am someone, I was reflecting, I was writing an article on my mother and, you know, and how she influenced my work as a community organizer. And so I think about it, and I was, you know, not to go through the whole story, but like, community organizing is not a science. It's not like you get this many people sign petition, you show up this place. You understand what I'm saying? It's an art. It's so many things, it's a living being. You know, so many things are happening. And you need to be like on that, you know, in that moment. And so I was raised, you know, I watched Walter Cronkite every night announce the body count in Vietnam. I remember that. That left a mark on me. You know, my mother took me to demonstrations. I watched them crack egg on a guy's head in front of the courthouse in Medford, that old redneck town. You know, I watched that. I lived that. And so I saw people who stood in very challenging situations. You know, I was just in Greensboro, where I went to the Museum of Civil Rights and Human Rights, and they bought the dang Woolworth store and turned it into a museum where they had the sit-in, right? And so now we go there and you get to learn about that. And we bought, you know, the former Enbridge office in Park Rapids, Minnesota. They leave town, we buy their office, turned it into a museum. Did I say that? Yeah, right. Because we wanted to tell our story, called Giwaydong Museum. That's where I work part-time, curator. But my point would be that you raise your children well and believe in them. You know, someone believed in us, right? Someone believed in us. And so I just do my best for that, you know, and then do as much as we can in our part to pass on as much goodness to them. And that also means take some arrests for your kids. I had charges in 4 counties a couple years ago. I have no jail this year. But the year is young. You know, take some charges for those young people. Take some charges for them. You know, that's what I would say. Because they're going to have a hard time. They're going to have knocks. They're going to take knocks, you know. And so I think about that, you know, and I think about how shameful it is to arrest elder women, too. But I was like, bring it on, guys. You're going to arrest us all? Go ahead. You know, but then just do your best for them and you know, teach them as much as you can. That's what I would say, you know.
So, having run for public office, what was your biggest takeaway, and do you think there can be political changes in the government?
Kind of looking like some tough sledding for a little while, but hang on. You know, and then, I mean, I think that there's some lessons. We don't want to go through the whole process right now, but we ought to get our act together, right? Y'all got that. Like, I am someone who has tried everything to make change. I've been arrested. I've been to the United Nations. I've been to Congress. I've run for national office, signed every petition. Been at every hearing, provided all the testimony. You got to do everything. Some of us have more, you know, of a stomach, we'll call it that, you know, or a gift for some things than others. Find your gift. Do your part. You know, whatever it is, because we all want to have, like, allies that are there, right? Allies that are in. So I believe in change in those offices, you know. I can't wait till Deb Haaland is the governor of New Mexico, right? And, yeah, you know, and then just look at, my God, look at Claudia in Mexico, huh? Y'all been watching her, the president of Mexico? I was like, go Mexico, right? So, you know, change happens in many ways. So just support that change and find your part.
I'm understanding that we're all here because we have a connection with the land. We all have a connection with the books that you have written. And so a question I have is, how do you balance your well-being as an indigenous environmental activist? You know, you're not just an environmental activist, you're an indigenous one. And that takes a lot of well-being, your mental well-being, your spiritual well-being. And I just want to know, as an indigenous student doing similar work, it's tiring. And sometimes it's just so hard to pick yourself up out of bed and go to school or do all of this work. And I want to know how you keep yourself balanced.
You know, when I was a student at Harvard, there was this guy named Masilo Mabeda, and he was a South African national who was a political refugee. He was a member of the African National Congress, right? The same party of Nelson Mandela. His name was Masilo Mabeda, and he and I were students together. He was a graduate student, and I was an undergraduate student. And one day we were sitting there in Adam's house, and we had this pile of books, and we were having some deep political discussion about the ANC and the American Indian Movement or something cool like that, right? And this one guy comes in. You know, this is Harvard. This is called the Gold Coast, this house that I lived in, Adam's house. And this guy comes in, and he says, Masilo, why do you work so hard? That's what he said to Masilo. And you know what Masilo said to him? He said, because you refuse to work. That is it. That is a part of it. It's like, we should not be doing all the work for all the students here. We should not be doing all the work for everybody. Everybody needs to do the work, right? Don't put it on all the Native students to do all the work, right? Don't do that, you know, because we're busy. We got stuff to do, right? Support us. Support us in our work here. I've turned into a student again. Oh. But no, I mean, that, you know, that was a really a significant lesson. But then, you know, on the other side of it, in my personal life, you know, where I live at the top of the Otter Tail River, which goes to the Red River, and I live in an ecosystem that is also the top of the Mississippi. I live at the top of the watershed. I live where the wild things are. So when I go to my daughter's house, which is on the other side of the lake, you know, pretty soon we're just going to canoe back and forth across, or in my, you know, my next round, I think I might just have a tin can to call her because I'm so sick of the cell phone. Anyway, so I go there, and every time I go there, there's like two otters that live there. There's some swans. There's like one heron. And people ask me sometimes, who do you work for, Winona? You know, they don't ask me that too much, but I say, oh, I work for that heron. So what am I saying? Like, we get to live in a beautiful world. And so my faith in this world is, and my faith in my responsibility is reaffirmed when I get to see that which is so beautiful. And so see that which is beautiful, because that's why we are here in this relationship. And restore yourself. And then make sure that you go, you know, hang with your people, do some good dance, you know, have some good salmon, you know, make sure that you do that, and life is good then, you know. And you all know the same thing, or, you know, one thing I noticed, I have a lot of PTSD from all those cops. I found that gardening really helped my PTSD. I don't know how else to say it, you know, but just go and do that. And I always tell young people, a hoe is a garden tool. We got to remember that. That's what a hoe is, a garden tool. And so that helps. You know, all that stuff helps. Okay.
Of all the projects you have been a part of and started, which has been the most impactful and important to you?
All those projects, you know, that is just my life, you know. I get to work on all kind of cool things, and different things are super at different times, you know, and are absolutely important. But, you know, over the course of my life, I seen we put sturgeon back in our river, right? And I look over there, and it's like 25 years later, and those sturgeon are having babies, and they're like all over. And every once in a while, someone says, I saw a sea monster in the lake. I was like, yeah, that's ours, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like, what are we doing here, right? Bring back some fish, watch some buffalo come home. Swans came back to our territory, right? Buy back a lot of land. That was my therapy program from Enbridge. You know, we did the White Earth Land Recovery Project, and around 2013, I left them to go work on the Enbridge pipeline and buy another 1,000 acres of land now. I felt a lot better buying land, you know, seeing land go back for traditional ways and ceremonies. So all those things, you know, are important. But I feel like that maybe one of the best things is that I get to hang out with people like you. But anyway, you know, the fact that you can share an idea and someone takes that idea and it helps them, that's pretty cool too. Because we all share with each other, and that's how we, you know, get to feel bigger in our hearts. It's been a good journey so far. Maybe I get some more land back and grow more corn varieties and hemp, right? And then, you know, right now, I'm on the edge of the new green revolution. That's what we call it. Because the Green Revolution was not so good in the end. You know that, like a lot of bad stuff happened. But the new Green Revolution, hemp can transform the materials economy. The word canvas comes from cannabis, right? You can make housing, you can make paper. And so I get to be in the revolution. That sounds pretty fun, huh? So I ain't done yet. I ain't done yet with that party, and I'm going to continue on. So anyway, thank you so much.
You were just listening to Winona LaDuc, Rights of Nature, An Indigenous View. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in March 2025. Winona LaDuc, an Anishinaabe elder, is an articulate representative of Indigenous perspectives. She's the author of many books, including To Be a Water Protector. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Robin D.G. Kelly, Heather Cox Richardson, Russell Means, Gabor Mate, and Francesca Albanese. And we have a series of Winona LaDuke programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Winona LaDuke, Rights of Nature and Indigenous View, and for her book, To Be a Water Protector, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Matt Laubach. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Robbie Robertson, Wandering Souls.
With white and gray feathers, a piercing stare, and noisy screams, the American herring gull is what most folks might call a seagull. But you're likely to see these gulls far from shore, too. The American herring gull is one of four nearly identical species found in temperate regions of the Northern Hemisphere, including the European herring gull, Vega gull, and Mongolian gull. In fact, ornithologists once lumped them all together under the single species name herring gull until 2024, when scientists found key differences in their genetics, appearance, and vocalizations. Just as raucous and hefty as its cousins, you can find American herring gulls from Alaska to Puerto Rico, squabbling over table scraps at an inland landfill, or scarfing down French fries by the beach. It takes juvenile herring gulls 4 years to grow into their iconic adult plumage. You can tell the youngsters apart from their elders by their speckled gray-brown body feathers. But even young birds can compete with the adults in size and volume. American herring gulls are about 2 feet long from beak to tail, with a nearly 6-foot wingspan that's perfect for soaring across land and sea. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is sponsored by Laura Potash of Roslyn, Washington.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CGSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.